Good morning, all. Good morning. Well, this is a meeting of the Safety and Operations Committee. It's January 16th, 2020, for the benefit of those in the room and out there in streaming land. We have today's agenda before us. If there are no objections to the agenda, we'll consider it approved as presented with one minor change to accommodate a guest. For the bus transformation item, I'd like to start with the Silver Line Phase 2 update, and then we'll do the bus transformation project resolution. Are there any objections to that change in the order? Seeing none, the agenda is approved. We also have minutes from our last meeting for approval. Could I get a motion from a committee member to approve the December 12 minutes? All right. Is so moved. A second? A second comes from Mr. Routh. Thank you. All in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Any opposed? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I abstain.
And please record an abstention from Mr. Letourneau. From Virginia. All right. The minutes are approved. Now on to today's meeting. We have two items before us today. The first is an update to the presentation the committee received in November on Phase 2 of the Silver Line with a specific focus on the construction issues that are underway or yet to be resolved before Metro is able to provide for acceptance of the Silver Line Phase 2 and begin revenue service in late 2020 or 2021. The second item is a return to a discussion on the bus transformation project that we had before us in December. The board will consider a resolution of acceptance or endorsement. Rob Quintas, the president and CEO of Eno Center for Transportation, is returning from last month for this item. He is joined by four other members of the Bus Transformation Executive Steering Committee members. And before we begin, I'd just like to note that Mr. Horner has recused himself from the agenda for this item, and Mr. Dorsey is absent today, and so Mr. Rouse and Mr. Letourneau will be participating in their places for the federal government and the Commonwealth of Virginia, respectively. So I'll now turn the floor over to the Chief Operating Officer, Joe Letter, to begin the Silver Line Phase 2 presentation. All right. There. We are awaiting the arrival of the Chief Operating Officer, and then we will begin the Silver Line Phase 2 presentation. Hold with us there a minute, all of those in streaming land. A word of warning, please, since we are live streaming today, if you're going to speak, please identify yourself and speak into the microphone with the little red light shown blinking. That way it will get recorded and it will be available for those listening in and as well as for posterity. We will begin in 10 seconds. Mr. Letter, as I brought to everybody else's attention, we are live streaming today. So please identify yourself and speak into the microphone. So
Joe Letter, Chief Operating Officer for Washington Metro.
Thank you.
Okay.
You can begin.
This presentation is an update to the November 21st presentation to the Safety and Operations Committee. Any new updates or changes from the November 21st presentation are highlighted in red. Next slide. In the previous presentations, we provided an overview of milestones identified here regarding the status of work on the Silver Line Phase 2. We also communicated plans for 13 weekend outages of the Wheeling-Reston East Station that were to commence between the end of November and mid-March to facilitate testing of the automatic train control system tie-in of Phase 2 to Phase 1. The Airports Authority's contract was not able to utilize the outages in December because the verification and validation documentation of the ATC software that was in our contract specifications was required, that was submitted by the contractor, was determined to be insufficient. In addition to not utilizing outages in December, outages scheduled in January and February have been canceled to date. This ATC software issue will be discussed later in the presentation as we move forward. During the previous updates to the board, this slide showed 12 identified issues. Now today, the ATC tie-in testing has been added, and an issue of concern bringing the total now to 13 items that we have concerns with. The ATC issue and the other eight issues indicated as either underway or unresolved will be discussed in the following slides. To summarize this issue, insulated joints, or IJs as they're referred to in the field, provide gaps required in the running rail to support the separation of track circuits for signaling purposes, while also providing structural continuity of the running rails to allow the trains to safely operate over the track. To date, the contractor has replaced selected IJs to address mechanical deficiencies based on periodic observations during their field assembly. For the remaining IJs not changed, the Airport Authority has identified a non-destructive method of determining if the other IJs need to be replaced due to mechanical deficiencies. And sample IJs are being shipped to a vendor to be used in a trial to determine the accuracy of the proposed scanning method. ATC testing of the IJs is completed, and Metro has approved their results. Metro awaits response, though, from the Airports Authority's contractor to comments we provided on the alternative power testing criteria implemented by the contractor. If any of the IJs are replaced with mechanical deficiencies, the Airport Authority, as well as the Airport Authority's contractor, will be required to retest the IJs as per the specifications. For clarification, the concern with the precast concrete wall panels at the buildings located in Dulles Yard is different in nature from the concerns with the concrete panels installed at the stations themselves. The issue of the panels at Dulles Yard regards cracking the panels that the Airport Authority concluded resulted from a deficiency in the design of the panel connections, which restrained thermal and shrinkage movements of the panel. The issue of the concrete panels at the station relates to deficiencies with properties of the concrete used in the casting of the panels and insufficient concrete cover of the reinforcing steel located inside of the panels. The Airports Authority is currently reviewing a life cycle analysis commissioned by their contractor in support of alternative remediation methods that would not require replacement or reapplication of the sealer. What they're looking to do is these cracks have not grown in size, so they're looking to correct the cracks, fix the cracks, and then apply a one-time sealer on the walls. We have and will continue to engage Metro's Office of Inspector in General to review any analysis of alternative remediation methods advanced by the Airports Authority, and we've been working with Renee's team hand-in-hand throughout their investigation. The Airports Authority's contract reported completion of corrective actions to address a tight gauge condition at 39 of the number 8 switches in the yard. Metro is awaiting coordination by the Airports Authority for track access to conduct an inspection of the repairs made. We hope to get in there in the next couple of weeks. After the Airport Authority's contractor became aware of the issues with achieving standard cross-level tolerance at special track work locations, the contractor replaced approximately 250 of the switch ties that had the most excessive camber. Although there are switch ties that remain installed that have camber in excess of contractual requirements, an analysis performed by a third party confirmed that there are no structural or longevity concerns regarding the remaining camber switch ties. It is anticipated that the remaining switch ties that exceed the camber requirements would only be replaced if the replacement would contribute to the resolution of the cross-level issue discussed in the next few slides. Rather than being a deficiency of track plates themselves, it has been determined that the excessive curvature of the track plates and the corresponding gaps below the plates result from bending forces imposed on the plates by the track fastening system. Exercises conducted in the field suggest that the non-standard components installed by the Airports Authority contractor to address the cross-level deficiency, particularly the thinner pads in the frog areas, may have caused the excessive gaps below the track plates. If the excessive curvature and gaps at the track plates are not addressed as a result of the accepted cross-level remediation, Metro will require a remedy to eliminate those gaps that are large enough that could potentially result in fatigue failure of the plates themselves. As a summary of the issue, the contractor was not able to achieve compliance with the contract requirements for cross-level tolerance at the special track locations. The contractor implemented a remedy that deviates from the approved design, including the use of thinner pads under the frog plates, thicker rail pads, and a variety of custom fabricated thicker guardrail plates in lieu of the specified 3/4-inch thick plates. We have not accepted this remedy. The remediation implemented by the contractor introduces unnecessarily difficult and complex maintenance requirements and was rejected by Metro. In efforts to identify the root cause of the cross-level deficiency, the Airports Authority directed its contractor to hire an outside third party to conduct a tamping exercise at one of the special track work locations. Starting in December, systems were disconnected at the horse pen crossover to facilitate the tamping exercise. The outside contractor then removed non-standard track components installed by the Airports Authority's contractor and replaced them with the as-specified components in the contract. The outside track work contractor used tamping equipment and jacking techniques over the course of several days in an effort to achieve compliant cross-level. The Airports Authority has reported that, pending final survey verification, significant cross-level improvement appears to have been achieved at this interlock. So based on what our third-party consultant had told us in the beginning, we felt all along that if they did proper tamping, they could resolve the issue, and it looks like this is how we would remediate the cross-level issue. In regards to the ballast deficiencies, as noted here, Metro's consultant identified 40 ballast sampling locations in the Dulles Yard and identified testing methods to be implemented. These sample locations are in addition to other sampling locations identified by the Airport Authority for further testing. The collection of the samples has been completed, as has the sieving of the samples to determine the percentage of the various size particles and contaminants that are inside the ballast. Data from the sieving of the samples is currently under review by Metro's consultant to support Metro's determination of what mitigations will have to take place once we get the final results back from our third party. As the remedy to various deficiencies with the precast concrete panels at the grade station, the Airport Authority's contractor applied 2 coats of saline sealer to all panels fabricated by the Universal Precast Concrete Incorporation. At the September 12th Safety and Operations Committee meeting, Metro's OIG reported after the application of the sealer, 20% of the samples tested by the sealer manufacturer had failed to achieve the required depth of penetration into the panels themselves. Using a revised application technique, an additional 2 coats of sealer was applied to the panels by the contractor. And at this time, I'd like to turn the mic over to Renee, who can give us an update on their investigation.
Good morning. I'm Renee Settles, Deputy Inspector General with Metro OIG. So as Joe said, and when we were here last time briefing, we were advised that 20% of the cores tested failed to achieve full penetration. And as a result, that information was presented to our concrete expert who was here last time, and he recommended that in order to ensure that Metro catches any corrosion early on through cracks in water penetrating the panel, that inspections be done, visual inspections be done 3 months. And that's where we're still at this position right now. We haven't changed. Recently, we received a call or communication from the quality control individual who works for CRC. We had interviewed him one time, and he wanted to come back and provide more information. He and his attorney came to our offices this week, provided information based on us doing our due diligence. We've then gone back to him, he and his attorney, and asked for some more information. We're waiting to receive that. We're in the hopes to receive that in the next week to take a look at that information. And it mostly involves statements made about the depth of the concrete. And so we've asked for information on every panel and what the depth of every panel is as we stand here today, information on what panels were scanned. We have received from the Airports Authority a listing of every panel, where they are, and their condition, which will be one of our recommendations to ensure that when this project gets turned over to Metro, that they have that information for their use and for future. So we are in the process of writing our report. We have a draft pending when we get that information from CRC. We're in the hopes to have a draft completed soon. That's where we stand, and we're also looking at doing inspections of each of the panels to identify which panel has cracks as we stand today, but that will be outside. So that's basically a summary of where we are.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Hicks? Yes?
If I could, just a point of information. Mr. Fables, when is the report, when do you think the report is going to be released? Because that's important information to have as we consider financial and other.
So we anticipated to have the final draft and issued to Mr. Newfeld, Mr. Leader, by the end of this month. If the information that we received takes longer than a month, the final report would probably be issued sometime by the beginning of February, middle of February, completely done.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is Paul Wheatville, General Manager. I just want to clarify one other issue, though. The OIG is also hiring an additional contractor to go out and inspect all 1,700 panels so that we have the baseline. That will not be in the report that they're finalizing now because that work is just getting underway.
Yeah.
So just so that the recommendation is that we inspect these every 3 months or whatever it is, we want to know what the baseline is that we start from. And that's what that review is going to do.
Okay. Let's come back to that after we finish. Let's let Mr. Letter finish the presentation. Then we can deal with some of these points in the Q&A. Thank you.
Sure. Software modifications are required to provide fully functional interlocking as we progress to the east, expanding from the current end-of-the-line functionality into accommodating the interface with Phase 2 ATC system. If the new software has not been properly validated and safety certified prior to loading it into the existing system at the beginning of each shutdown for testing, there is a risk of residual negative impacts to the existing system when the software is removed at the end of the shutdown. And we've been working with MWAN to get this documentation as soon as possible. In summary, the Airport Authority still states project substantial completion will be April of 2020. At this time, Metro cannot establish a service date target until all identified deficiencies are resolved, including this new area of concern in agency testing, and this, which we're waiting on, certified software. Metro has also requested the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission to conduct an extensive pre-revenue service review, including review of the known deficiencies identified by Metro already. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. I'm sure these presentations by the Chief Operating Officer and the OIG, Mr. Pebbles, have raised a lot of questions. And let me start with two questions we'll explore, and then we'll just open it up generally since it's an information item. If you have questions, just raise your hand, and I'll recognize you without regard to whether you're on the committee or not. First, on this issue that you just dealt in your last slide, slide 13, which is also talked about in slide 11 with this automatic train control validation verification issue, could you describe that in a little greater detail? What exactly is it that needs to be validated or verified, and who's responsible for doing that, and where are we in the timeline of getting that validation or verification which you need?
Okay, so in the contract specs that were developed and given to MR from us, in there is language that talks about safety certification when it comes to software. Within the last year, we've been reminding MR at some point we need to validate and test the signaling system, because the signaling system on phase one is different, it's a different manufacturer than phase two. So there has to be a tie-in at the wheel interlocking. So we've been reminding them that we need this certification, we need the documentation. We were told we would receive it in December, just prior to the start of the 55-hour general orders. They requested 13 weekends to do this work. The first 2 weekends were really to set up some equipment, so those 2 weekends were done. When we finally got the download of all the data or documents that we requested, ATC Engineering, which is now on the Lower Basin, did a review of it and found out that the safety certification of the software was not included in the package. At that point, we made a decision not to risk anything, but to cancel the rest of at least December's 55-hour general orders and bring MR in with their contractor. Their contractor who performed or developed the software called the software that was the base software from Allstar. Their feeling is that they don't have to recertify, and we're saying that you do. And we directed MR that we will not perform any more testing until safety certification of that software is performed. We give them three options. They picked one of the options. One of the options is to go back to Alstom, who has the capability of testing it in their lab, to assert that whatever we do by inserting these boards, you know, on the weekends, removing them, we're not going to do anything to phase one of our signaling system. So that's where we are right now. We were being assured all along that they were working on it, but again, when we got the documents in December, the safety certification that was required in our specifications was not present.
All right, so looking in slide two at the timeline that you presented at the start of your presentation today, so what you're saying is what was supposed to happen in, I guess, the third green block, static testing, hasn't happened yet.
Static testing is ongoing because we can perform some static testing in other parts of phase two. Dynamic testing has begun in phase two, but we will not be able to complete everything until we have this tie-in performed that really well.
So you've said that you've canceled the testing for January and February at Wheelie Reston.
Yes.
Yes.
But the rest of the testing in phase two can continue.
So does that mean that we're 60 days, 45 to 60 days delayed from this schedule that has to be made up?
Unfortunately, I can't answer that because MR has not given us a schedule. We know that they've been in touch with Alstom. They're trying to develop scope of work for that whole portion of the contract. We'll probably award to Alstom, but we have not got the schedule. So when it comes to how much is this delaying the project, I don't know.
But I think it's delayed it somewhat more than is shown in the last slide, 14, which assumed that there would be substantial completion by April 2020?
Correct. I mean, we believe just amongst our engineers, if everything went according to plan with no other delays, that probably we could resume testing sometime in March or April. But that is up to MWOC to direct the contractor to hire Alstom to do the certification if there will be a delay. So we don't have a schedule, we don't have a real good idea right now how MR's solving this issue.
Okay. Let's then shift to where we began discussing with the precast concrete panels at the six stations. And I guess that's slide 12. And I guess, Mr. Pebbles, I guess as the general manager indicated, there's sort of two things going on that OIG is doing. You know, one is the additional visual inspection of the panels, the recommendation for 3 months, and then there's a inspection going on of the panel of what was done by the sealants that were most recently applied. Is that sort of correct, that there's sort of two things out there that OIG is doing?
So if there are two things that OIG is out there doing. So the first was to get the results of whether the sealant penetrated or not, get an understanding of where all the panels are. The second piece that the general manager has indicated is to go out and inspect every panel, all 1,700 panels, to make a determination at this point, are any of them cracked at this point? Is there rust, stains appearing on those panels? And to present that data to Metro for them to make a better informed decision as to what they would like.
And what's the timeline of that inspection process?
So we have to go through the procurement process. We are hoping that by the end of this month we'll have a contractor selected. And, you know, our statement of work, you know, we would want them to complete that within 30 days. If possible, they have to tell us, well, no, it's going to take longer, or we can do it shorter, but our goal is within 30 days.
All right. And when you were here in December, you had indicated that the OIG recommendation was that there should be visual inspection every 3 months. Is that still the OIG recommendation, or does that depend on some report that we're going to get in either early February or the end of February?
We still stand on the three-month period. The other work that we're doing on the cracks has no bearing on that. That's just basically where are those panels today, and do any of them show signs of cracking? Our contractor believes that if you see rust stains or cracks, that is the point when you should be focused on fixing them or replacing them. And that's why he has requested every 3 months. That we have not moved to answer your question.
Okay. And so the question is to Mr. Lederer, do we have a cost estimate of what the cost will be of doing those inspections every 3 months?
Both? We're starting to prepare something. One of the things we've asked in this contract that's being done is that the contract provides us how many panels can be truly inspected in an 8-hour period, so we can learn what types of equipment would be required for the inspection. And then the other thing that we would have to discuss is if there are cracks found, what is going to be the remedy? Is it going to be replace the panel, or is it going to correct the, or come up with a procedure to correct the crack? We haven't even begun to discuss those options with MR as we move forward.
Right. I guess that's what I was trying to hone in on, because the last bullet on the slide, you know, says that you've rejected the remediation proposed so far for the panels until the Airport Authority proposes a safe and effective long-term solution. So do we have a proposal from the Airport Authority as yet for remediation for a long-term solution?
No, right now they're still sticking to the two extra coats that are added. They believe they're and I don't know if Renee's consultant has reviewed the results, but they believe by adding the two additional coats of the sealer that they now have reached the penetration depth that was required, and that the manufacturer of the sealer is now willing to give us a warranty. But it's only a warranty on the sealer. It's not a warranty on the panel itself.
All right, so is that the proposal from MR, or is MR waiting for the completion of these studies before it makes a remediation proposal?
It's their proposal right now, but we have the ultimate right, okay, to either accept this project or reject it. That is in our contract with MR. So when we get the report back, we will have to sit down and make a determination whether or not we will accept the panels or not.
And the timing of that looks like it will be late February, early March at the earliest?
I think I would say yes, because then we would have the results of the inspections that would performed by the third party that's being hired now.
And I assume at that point you have some cost estimates for board members to understand what the cost would be of accepting the panels in their current state?
We will probably have some, but we won't have it all, because we'll have to wait to see the results of the inspection and whether or not, if there is cracking, what will our decision be? Is it replace these panels now before we open up, or is there a remedy of fixing the crack and then resealing? So we have to, we won't know just because we'll have a better understanding once we get the inspection report back from Renee, but we won't have any final answers at that point.
Right. And I think from November, December, it was your view that if we did accept the panels as is and just did the visual inspections every 3 months, that that would require a good deal of single tracking for the do the panels that were on
correct.
Right away?
These panels are located in different locations throughout the stations. Some are on the outside of stations, some are over the trackway, some are over on escalators, so we have concerns, and that's why we're going to be interested to see how these inspections are performed. Because when the panels were installed, the escalators were not fully functional. Now we have fully functional escalators with these panels alongside. So how do we get up there and actually inspect them? So we're going to be really interested to see how Renee's consultant does this type of inspection.
Well, I mean, it's certainly this board member's view that we'd like to understand fully the ongoing maintenance cost that would be incurred if you decide to accept the panels without total replacement, as to what the cost would be, both in terms of doing these kind of inspections every 3 months, as well as what the costs involved would be in terms of single tracking and the lost revenues that would be incurred in that kind of a exercise if you decide to go down that route, since we have to make a decision at the end of the line here. I think that all that information would be helpful to the board members in making that decision. All right, other board members? Mr. Letourneau?
So picking up on that, so just by way of context here, is the concern with this the life of the panels? You know, do these have a certain life expectancy, like, say, 100 years, and it's believed that that is degraded by potentially some of these issues?
So the design specs call for these panels to last. The issue is because we've had annual reviews in this company from the Senate to Florida, because there were issues with the water cement ratio, and because we have concerns of the depth of the concrete from the surface to the rebar, that if there were cracks that would happen, this sealer, while it did penetrate, will not protect water from getting in through the crack. And because now you have a closer distance, if it hits the rebar and reacts with the aggregate, it will cause an expansion of the rebar, which would then could cause a degradation of the panel.
To what extent? I mean, I'm just trying to get an idea of the scope of the problem. You know, does that mean the life expectancy is X less, or we just don't know?
Just don't know, and that's why we're calling for the 3 months. When you start seeing that corrosion, you can address it, you can fix it at that point. If you wait longer than that, then
this 3 months, though, seems very aggressive for a problem that you're probably talking about a degradation of 100 years down to 80 years or 70 years, as opposed to immediate. So could it be that upon inspection, that ends up not being necessary, and instead it becomes a yearly or something like that? I mean, is that, you just don't know yet?
I don't think we'll ever know. I mean, that you have to inspect these, and I would not want to stake anything on telling anybody, you can wait a year, you can wait. You know, I'm standing behind what our concrete expert says. He says 3 months would be the comfort point that he would have.
Now, Metro has had its own experts looking at this. Is there agreement between the OIG and Metro's experts on all of these issues?
In this case, we've allowed the OIG to take the lead, okay? Of the 12 or 13 deficiencies that we've identified, Renee and I have worked out which consultants that I have will look at certain ones. When we came to the concrete panels, it was their investigation, and we're waiting for, we'll look at the recommendations from there and concrete as per.
Okay. So it seems like I'm stating the obvious, but it seems highly unlikely, given these issues, particularly the last issue, which I think may be the more significant one of everything regarding software, that we would hit substantial completion in April. And I understand that you may not be able to definitively tell us when that would happen, but it just seems like the circumstance of events that would have to occur to hit substantial completion in April would be extraordinary. So are you at least comfortable acknowledging that that April substantial completion is unlikely at this point?
I'll just say that the April date is an M1 date. This is okay. They provided us and they're sticking to it. I kind of agree that being the fact that we have not had resolutions to 9 of these issues, I think the April date is not realistic.
But the April date is on which we're basing our October date for revenue and budget purposes.
Correct.
So it does impact our, I mean, I think at some point Metro should make its own calculation here because there is a there is a budgetary impact to this.
Thank you. Mr. Rouse.
Thank you. So I'd like to jump back to the track real quick. And it sounds like on the positive side, you're at least making some progress. You know, I was a little worried last time we talked that we would find ourselves here in some sort of impasse on what the solutions might be. But given the amount of work they've done in the replacement, it sounds like with that 250 ties replaced, that's really gone a long way on helping resolve some of those problems, and I'm hoping that's because they were the bad actors that really needed to be removed from the track. But my main concern remaining there is that while tamping certainly always helps, if those ties still have some deficiency in them, unlike timber ties and other types of cross ties, you're going to have a very different scenario with ballast and concrete ties. Unlike timber, where you can actually get a little bit of indentation onto the timber from the ballast and it will help hold it there, concrete's just going to pound at that ballast. And so my concern's that although you may be within your tolerance or acceptable tolerance right now, is it going to stay there? And can you live with that in terms of maintenance? To pay that much money for concrete ties versus any other type of construction and not get the expected reduction in maintenance costs would be what you'd be looking at here. If we always have to tamp those particular turnouts at an unusually high rate, then you know what are we getting? What do we pay for here? What are we going to end up doing in the long term? So I would think one short-term issue here is to see how these turnouts handle under load, right? And I mean when I say revenue load, usually it doesn't mean with passengers or anything like that. It just means cycles. You need to get axles over that, because that's going to start vibrating that ballast, and you'll see if you're going to go back to that natural state where that tie camber wants to pull those ties back to a different shape, or if you've really remediated the problem with these ties that you've replaced and all of a sudden you're where you want to be. I don't know. I think you're going to need to do a little bit of work with the authority and them to see if there's a way you can monitor this and validate that that solution that they've come up with is one that's going to be acceptable for you long term, particularly as it relates to your maintenance costs.
No, correct. As we are looking at all the issues that could lead to maintenance issues in the future, servicing is going to be one of them because of the fact that every time you take that track out of service, especially a lot of these interlockings, we're going to need both tracks at the same time. It's going to be a costly effort. We will not only just be taking static testing, we'll also be the hydrology car out there running to see what kind of deviations we're getting under load. But also, as they do the dynamic testing, we're going to have trains that are going to be riding over them. So, you know, after we get the initial results from MR, we can go back in about a month or so and reevaluate what the cross level is to see if we're starting to get deviations. But it is something we're looking at long term and making sure that there will be money.
And I think that's going to be essential because it's one thing to say we made it, we got it into spec, but it's another thing to actually have it stay there when you actually start operating. So, can you go back to the ATC issue real quick, our other favorite topic? Did I hear you correctly? You said the third party had altered the software from Alston?
Correct.
And they didn't feel that it was necessary to recertify safety critical software?
Correct. They felt the modifications they made to the software would have no effect. We disagree with them, and that's what we instructed them on.
So they didn't write the software. They went ahead and modified it, and they don't feel that. I've never heard of that, to be honest with you, in terms of safety critical software, especially in train control. Most of these companies follow a very specific process, especially when it comes to software, because it's very easy to make a mistake on the software side. So I think that would be essential. Now, my main concern there, though, isn't getting the validation done from a technical standpoint. You know, Alstom and some of these other companies are very good when you can get their attention, but can you get the time of day in terms of their capacity? Most of these train control companies are very thin at the moment. Many of them don't have any software people to begin with because they're fighting for software experts against the Googles of the world and everybody else, and it's really hard to get and retain people that have that expertise. And with everybody fighting for train control engineers and software engineers at the moment and time and attention from these suppliers with Positive Train Control and other efforts that are going on this year, it may be very difficult, and I think we need to be very realistic about whether or not we're going to get that attention from the supplier to get you those dates that we've been talking about here. So I think that's one thing we're going to have to keep a close eye on, because although it seems like a small lift, just getting the time and attention from the supplier may be a difficult task. So, and it's not something you want to skip on. It's certainly something you want to take your time and do it correctly.
Definitely in agreement with you. That is one of the issues we're concerned with.
Thank you. Mr. Mulder?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we go to the last slide, please? The result from the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission, I think Barbara sent us an email this morning, but I haven't had time to read it. Is that appropriate now to discuss what the Metro Rail Safety Commission findings are?
This is Paul Wienerveld, General Manager. We just got the letter at 8:20. I just don't. I don't think we should discuss it now until we have some time to review it.
Okay. Thank you.
Another question, Mr. Boulder?
No.
Very good, Mr. Chair. Mr. Slater.
Good morning. Thank you, Greg Slater, Secretary of Railroad DOT. Back on the concrete panel, a two-part question. One is, am I hearing correctly that the recommendation is just for a visual inspection? And if that's true, then was there any consideration given to something more non-destructive testing, like penetrating radar or anything along that line to get compressive strength or anything like that?
Yes, you're correct. It's a visual inspection. We did not consider anything else because, based on our consultant's position, just seeing the rust stains appear were enough.
Do you have a follow-up question, Mr. Slater? Mr. Smedberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad Mr. Rouse raised the software issue, Mr. Leader. And something else you said in your presentation sparked my interest, and I'm curious how they're linked. You said the integration of Phase 1 and Phase 2 signal systems are different, or there's two different systems. How are we going to integrate those two systems, or how does that happen? And is this software part of that integration?
In a system as big as ours or any other, you don't normally end up, especially when it's built out in different phases, to have the same signal system. So this is standard stuff that will come up in contracts. That was some of the information that we were waiting for in December, was not only to get the certification of the software, but to have a testing plan, okay, that our ATC engineering group would approve.
Okay,
and we are working with consultants, and we have the plan of how they want to test it. We're fine with the testing plan of what they want to do, but what we're not fine with is we're waiting on this safety certification of the software.
Okay. And also, Mr. Leader, are all the panels you're discussing here today in the various locations, are they all the same size? Are they all the same thickness? Are all panels equal, or do you have five different panels?
Many different panels. In fact, because of the issues that we have, we are working on the assumption that none of the panels are one is different from the other. But to answer your question, some of the panels have brick facade in front of them. Some of them are slanted panels. Some of them are toe kicks. Some of them are graded. Others are flat. So completely, they're all different.
So following up on Secretary Slater's question, so how does that complicate or challenge you to, you know, come up with a recommendation to bring to the board about accepting this project? And how does that factor into your report that you're going to be passing on to the board ultimately in February?
So, core samples have been taken of all types, and so we received the results. So it's not difficult in determining whether the solution penetrated or not, which is what we have been looking for. This added work that we're doing with the cracks is very important because there will be an up-close visual inspection to determine whether they're cracks. And that is an important data point for Metro officials to make a determination whether they decide to keep them, remove them, or whatever the decision is. So it's not a difficult task for us because we've gotten to the inside, we've gotten the results. There have been many, many experts looking at this. I think we will be comfortable when it comes down to our recommendation to inspect these every 3 months and make sure that somebody has the eye on the ball as to whether these things are there's corrosion that has already occurred.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Leader, as it relates to the track plates, are you looking for or trying to work toward a solution that would have some sort of standardization along the entire stretch of phase two? In other words, you don't want to have 50 different size plates to address deficiencies. And is some level of standardization even possible?
Well, the Tampanet exercise that was performed at Horsepen, they put back the standard plates that were specified in the contract. And it appears they're able to get the cross level we requested in the contract. It's a zero cross level plus or minus an eighth of an inch. So once we can validate that horse pit came out the way MY and the contractor saying the results that they got, our recommendation would be then to go back to all the interlockings, replace this, take out the modified plates, put in the standard plates as per the contract, and continue resurfacing the rest of the interlocking. But we're not there yet, so we have to make sure we can validate what they did at Horse Pen. But yes, we want to get rid of all the non-standard plates. We want to keep it standard. It makes it much easier in the future for the maintenance forces as they change rail, they change broken plates, that we don't have different size plates that we have to not only keep in storage, okay, but also, the case could be we put the wrong plate in on the wrong tie. So we want to go with standard plates. That's our goal. We think the tamping exercise worked, that they can go back, put in the standard plates, and resurface the rest of the interlockings.
Okay. As it relates to the ballast issue, worst case scenario, I guess we would have to replace ballasts. How difficult is that procedure or process?
It's not that difficult. They've already actually started working on that. What our consultant is doing is now trying to work and identify, okay, at this location, how far out do we go? Do we go 25 feet on each side of that location? Would that be considered a good parameter to use? So they're working to finalize their report and come up with the requirements that we can go back to MY and MY's contractor and say, here's the locations that are contaminated, and this is the parameters that we expect to be done. Remove the ballast. And usually it's done by vacuum trucks.
Okay.
That's what they would do.
Okay. And last question. Earlier in the presentation, you mentioned the March-April testing, or you referred to the time frame from March-April testing. What was that?
If everything went well, and they could develop a scope of work, MWAS contractor would also, get that procured get Alstom to certify and then get us the data, we probably need about 2 to 3 weeks, our engineering group to review the certification. We think the earliest they could start probably retesting the wheeling interlocking sometime mid-March, the end of March, or April. But again, I do agree that the resources of that portion of the industry is being tapped right now with PTC, and it may be difficult for Alstom to say, I can drop everything here and get this done. So we do not have a schedule right now from MWAT or their contractor as to when they think they would have the safety certification to us. And then again, we would probably need 2 to 3 weeks just to, with our engineers to go through the certification to make sure we're comfortable with it before we can start testing.
And as it relates specifically to the certification or the willingness to recommend an acceptance, all these issues you're talking about, particularly the red items, and possible fixes, do you think that these recommended, you know, ultimate fixes for these things will meet the standards outlined in the contract, the minimum acceptable standards in the contract?
I don't think they will meet the standards of the contract because there's deviations right now.
Right.
Because we have camera ties and stuff like that. We would probably have to accept, okay, that we would be accepting stuff that doesn't meet the specifications of the contract perfectly. And I think we can make that decision. I think of all the items that are underway or not resolved yet, I think for the most part, we have some acceptable solutions. I am still, you know, not there when it comes to the concrete panels. I am concerned there, not only from what the inspection is going to reveal, as well as is it feasible to go on for the next 10, 20 years, every 3 months, inspecting these panels.
Well, as we've seen in the station renovation projects, what concrete and rebar and proper, you know,
right,
all the mess you can have there. So,
yeah.
Right.
I'm still out when it comes to the concrete panels.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Stephanie, good to be.
Stephanie.
No problem. So going back to the concrete, just this is more of a general public understanding. On average, what would be the life expectancy, like where you would start to see the rust in the cracks that we're seeing?
I can't answer that question. I mean, it can happen at any. I mean, it could already be happening. Until we inspect it, we won't know. I mean, it's really, because we have all these issues, it's just hard to tell when they would start.
Even regarding the like failed penetration test that had happened in the past, like on average, how much time would that usually, when would you have expected to see something like this for a standard project that was done properly following all of the standard protocols?
So I can tell you, I talked to our concrete, the way I posed our concrete expert, the way I posed the question to him was, if the concrete was manufactured correctly, if you didn't have the water cement, if you didn't have the ASR, if you didn't have depth issues, I asked him, would you do these 3 months three-month inspections? And the answer was no, not at all. We wouldn't have needed to apply the sealer necessarily. As we sit here today, I don't know the answer. I should certainly get it for you as to when and if you would see it, but I imagine that it wouldn't be within the first year.
Okay. And then in terms of just the timeline, what we would think could be a more realistic timeline than April 2012 in terms of meeting all of these challenges identified? Even at a very basic level, what feels like a more realistic timeline for us to be really expecting some of these pieces?
This is Paul Wiedenfeld, General Manager. I don't think we can say that now. A, we have missing information. You know, we can't guess to some of these things. I think we have to keep churning through these issues. I think the report on the concrete will give us some some direction. I think the cross-level issue is coming to a point where we will be able to get a better sense of that. But we haven't verified these things yet, so they've been put in place. They haven't been verified yet by us. So once we verify that, I think we get a little bit better sense of that. But again, we're not managing the contractor. And right now, the airport's authority is saying substantial completion is April. So, you know, we can't just assume that that's not coming either. We have to also plan that if this does come to us in a fairly short order, April, May, June, where are we in terms of ramping up? So that's the issue, and I think it's a policy issue for the board to decide, you know, do we not accept that we want to push this off to a different time? That's, again, a policy issue. But operationally, we can't, right now, we can't give you a date because there's just too many unknowns. But we have to react to the airport and the contractor saying we're done.
I'm not going to get a date.
A lot of these issues are contractual pieces with the contractors. When you guys have been and talked to them, why do they fully?
No, scare people.
Are they truly feeling like April is the standard of where they're pushing for at this current time? Just given, especially the December delay.
It's still their date.
Thank you. Mr. Wheatfield, I understand your reluctance to predict an actual date, but it seems if we look at this summary slide that's up here now, which assumed substantial completion in April 2020, which would lead to revenue service if you count out the dates since September 2020, that's not happening. We've clearly lost maybe 60 days at the start of this process. So that substantial completion date is probably May or June at this point, which would mean a start of service in the best of circumstances, a heroic circumstances at the end of the year. And that doesn't reflect any resolution of the precast concrete panel issue. So, I mean, my take from all this is that in the best of circumstances, revenue service may start at the very end of 2020, and in the worst of circumstances, if the issue concerning precast concrete panels isn't resolved, we're looking at sometime in 2021 without being able to predict an exact date. At least that's how I read it. If you have any comments, or Mr. Lederer or Mr. Ferber have any comments on that, I think the members of the committee and the board are open to hearing that. Seeing none, I think we'll thank you for your presentation today. We'll ask you to come back in 60 days and tell us where we are in March before Easter. Maybe that's a good time to get an update. And we'll have a better sense of what this timeline means for both the actual start of revenue service as well as for budgetary issues for the board.
Budget.
So thank you very much, gentlemen. We'll now move to the bus transformation project. Good morning. I guess we're ready to proceed on the bus transformation project. This is Mike Goldman, chair of the Safety and Operations Committee. We have a distinguished panel from the bus transformation project. I will ask Mr. Wiedefeld to introduce the gentleman here today, and then we'll move on to, I assume, a brief presentation and consideration of a resolution.
Great. Good morning. I'm Paul Wiedefeld again, the general manager. With us today is Stu Schwartz, Ian Stubbs, Prentes, and Jack McDougall. I just want to make a few comments before turning it over to Rob. As you know, we spent the last few years focusing very much on rail, and we're starting to see the fruits of that effort. We saw it with our recent ridership numbers. But I strongly believe that we need to do much, much more on the bus. It represents almost 40% of our enterprise in terms of passengers served daily. It's a very important part of the system for a number of people and for the economy of this region and the air quality and the overall environment of this region. This panel, these members that are here today, represent a much larger panel that have given their time over the last 18 months to wrestle with some very difficult issues. And to be frank, they're issues that individually operators have not been able to solve and to really deal with maybe in the degree we need to deal with. So I think the work that they've done does that. As you've seen in our proposed budget, a number of the recommendations that came from the panel, we are proposing as well. Mr. Dave Richardson is here also from Southwest Airlines. I really don't think we should take lightly the task we have in front of us to get bus to where we need it to be. It will take the same level of effort that we've put towards the rail. It will take the same level of commitment from all of our partners to do it. And I think that's the bottom line of what the report says, is this is a much larger issue than just Metro Bus, and that as a region, we need to tackle this for the future of the region. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rob.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wiedefeld. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for having us here today. Robert Fuentes with the group called the ENO Center for Transportation, and I've had the honor over the last 18 months to chair this Executive Steering Committee for the Bus Transformation Project. As requested by this committee, we have returned to seek more endorsement of the BTS, the Bus Transformation Study, and its recommendations. I know Paul introduced everybody, but let me just take the opportunity to quickly introduce the other members of the Executive Steering Committee that are here with me today. David Richardson, the head of the DC office for Southwest Airlines, also serves on a commission that oversees the Port of Baltimore. Stuart Schwartz is the founder and executive director of the Coalition for Smart Growth. CSG, as you know, played a central role in the Metro Now Coalition to secure Vermont's first ever dedicated funding. Ann Stubbs is the former executive director of the Coalition of Northeastern Governors Policy Research Center, where transportation was a priority issue, particularly enhanced passenger service on the Northeast Corridor. And Jack McDougall, the president and CEO of the Greater Washington Board of Trade, also a member of the Metro Now Coalition. Bobby Cannon, the president of the 2030 Group, is a coalition of business leaders all across the region. I think he's on his way. He's stuck in traffic, so he should have been taking transit. He would have been here on time. But it was an excellent...
He didn't take a bus, right?
It really was a stellar group of individuals, as Paul said, really dedicating an awful lot of time and expertise to what we found was a critically important and nationally important effort. So I have been on many of these boards and task forces and coalitions before. I have never been on one where the committee was so focused on making sure this was not a report that sits on the shelf. We say that all the time, and then you forget it, and report sits on shelves. The committee members were absolutely focused on making sure that the recommendations and the strategy that was laid out in this report actually has achievable ways to be implemented. That was uniformly across the entire committee. So we're not going to go through the presentation today. The content of the strategy and the action plan is basically the same as it was last December. However, I do want to note that the presentation that's in your packet includes information to respond to some of the questions that the committee members had last time we were here. Notably, the board members inquired about the level of involvement from all the jurisdictions and the local bus providers throughout the project's development. This was not just a WMATA effort. This really was very intentionally designed to be stretched throughout the region, include all the local governments and the providers. So some new slides lay out the interviews, the briefings, and of course, the numerous meetings of the project's technical team and the strategic advisory panel, both of which had multiple jurisdictions from each, representatives from each jurisdiction. So the specific people that were included and involved in this project is inside the back cover of both the strategy documents and the action plan summary. Those were distributed last month, and they are on the project's website. Again, I want to thank you very much for your support and your attention to this really critical issue. I want to see if any of the other executive steering committee members want to make any final remarks.
Stuart Schwartz, Coalition for Smarter Growth. I have to say that I am very proud of our fellow executive committee members, as well as everyone else on the strategic and technical advisory committees that were involved in this. This is a regional report. This is our report. It's not just WMATA's report, and it's about all the bus service in the region. We work with local activists all across this region. They are deeply distressed about the condition of bus service at this point. They want this sort of attention to it, that the region really needs to own the bus service, needs to address it in a unified manner, working together, including, you know, addressing both the WMATA bus service and the local bus services. We said in this very strongly we wanted bus to be the mode of choice, and we're going to have to do a lot of work to get there, and we're certainly urging the commitment of this board and every elected official in this region to do so. Thanks.
I want to concur with what Steve said and add just a word that we also try to be very careful in putting the ideas together.
Can I ask you to identify yourself?
Yes,
we're live streaming this, so for posterity's sake.
I'm Ann Stubbs, former executive director of the Koenig Policy Research Center. But we also try to be very sensitive to make sure that the information and the recommendations that we're forwarding to you are ones that will be meaningful and useful to busy decision makers who have to juggle a lot of competing interests. And we're very sensitive to the complexities of dealing with and improving and investing in systems, transportation systems that cross jurisdictional lines. So we try to be very careful and sensitive to the competing pressures that you face.
Good morning. My name is Jack McDougall, and I'm with the Greater Washington Board of Trade. First, I'd like to applaud Paul and all of you for taking on bus transit as an issue. Oftentimes, it's overlooked. We put a lot of attention on rail. We put a lot of attention on individual vehicles. But we really need an all-of-the-above solution in this region if we're going to deal with the growth. Our members across the business community are extremely worried about bringing workers to the workplace. And so we need to really be thinking in terms of how do we use all of our resources and assets much more effectively than we have in the past. And the needs are only going to get bigger. You know, we anticipate adding 1 million jobs to our region over the next 20 years. So even if we were to double capacity on bus and metro, we still have our current congestion problems. So we really need to think about this holistically, and bus really does need to be at the forefront. And just from a transparency perspective, I ride the bus to work every morning. And I certainly do recommend it. And it's a solution that can serve a lot of our communities across this region. And so I do applaud all of you for taking this on. And we look forward to your continued support to make this happen.
Yeah, I guess I'll chime in. My name is David Richardson. I'm with Southwest Airlines. And I'm happy to be here to show support for this effort. Mr. Wiedefeld asked me to join this working group a while ago, I guess a year and a half, can't believe it, and just very honored. And what really interested me was I'm a daily user of WMATA services. I've used all services. I live in Maryland, trying to commute here in D.C. like hundreds of thousands probably of other people. And I must say I rarely use the bus, unlike my colleague here, because I just don't have the confidence in the schedule reliability of bus service. And maybe it's ignorance on my part, but there's something about Metro Rail, for instance. You know when the train's going to come, and you know when the train's going to get there. So you feel confident as a business person trying to attend a meeting. So I was very intrigued by the focus of this working group. And I must say, I've been on other these types of working groups. I have never seen the amount of time and dedication the staff and the consultants took in this effort. I mean, actually, it was overwhelming at times, the amount of meetings and conference calls. So I just want to just really commend WMATA and also everyone involved in this effort for the effort they put into it.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for your support. We'll turn back
here. Thank you very much, and I want to thank you on behalf of myself, the committee, and the board generally for the amount of time and the work you've put into this bus transformation project over the last year, year and a half, and especially your willingness to come back again today in January after being present here in December and making your presentation with the recommendations that we decided to delay for 1 month so that board members and the jurisdictions could consider your recommendations in framing a resolution of endorsement and support. And so we've completed that process over the last month. There's been some consultation among board members with the jurisdictions, and we have in front of you, members of the committee, a resolution that hopefully we will act on today, and basically just to describe the resolution from the, I'll use it for Dave Richardson's benefit, from the 30,000-foot level. This is a resolution which essentially endorses the broad scope of what the bus transformation project has proposed. In the second resolve paragraph, the board in broad terms endorses your vision, but puts aside the specific recommendation for a task force that was in your report, and instead directs staff to engage with the jurisdictions and the responsible parties, the providers of bus service in the region, to develop an action plan that considers the bus transformation project recommendations to the extent feasible and financially prudent. And in terms of those high-level recommendations, I guess I should just state what they are. They are to provide frequent and convenient bus service that connects communities, gives buses priority on roadways to move people quickly and reliably, and third, to create an excellent customer experience to retain and increase ridership with the bus system. So the resolution goes on in the fourth resolve paragraph to urge this ad hoc group to give favorable consideration to 9 specifics of your recommendations for early and immediate implementation. And among those, as the general manager has already pointed out, are some things that are actually in our FY 2021 budget that we are going to be considering both in the next session today and over the next few months, and that includes providing free transfers between Metrobus and Metrorail, creating and implementing a mobile app solution for a Metrorail, Metrobus, and local bus service providers, developing regional bus pass solutions, and supporting implementation of bus priority projects such as bus-only lanes, which we're working very closely with the district to make a reality for Metrobus in the district and in some other routes in the near future. So with that brief summary, I will entertain a motion by a member of the committee to move the draft resolution.
Second,
Mr. Letourneau. Any discussion? Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to, you know, say, I mean, this is great work, and I think people are good. And, I mean, the draft resolution, I think, thank you, Mr. Chair, for taking suggested changes on that. But I really would like to take this opportunity to encourage WMATA staff in particular to really work with the jurisdictions. I know, Mr. Puentes, you know this, on the Virginia side, all the jurisdictions have their systems, you know. You know, I think it's going to be really important that we engage with them in a, you know, in a significant way and make sure that they are, you know, at the table, you know, at these discussions or, you know, when this discussion continues, because this next phase is really the important phase of this project, and to not have them there in a significant way and represent them, you know, would be a failure. So hope we really engage with them.
Mr. Letourneau?
Yeah, I would just echo what Chairman Smedberg said on that point. I think this discussion is a starting point, and it's a great starting point. We all have, I think, in Maryland, the district in Virginia, our own systems, our own sort of way of doing things, and I think going forward, potentially some different priorities. And so getting all those together in one way is going to be a challenge. But I think the framework is here with all this information and all of this input and all the work that was done to have a really good conversation. And I know, and certainly in Virginia, we're excited about some of the projects that we have, including a really good BRT project that's moving forward to try to make some progress on the overall quality of service.
Stephanie?
Stephanie Gibby. I also just wanted to personally thank you all for really, truly putting in the time that you guys have done. I think as someone who also uses the bus and it has been a bus advocate, really thinking about the 600,000 riders who are using the bus every day, I think this is not just a benefit for the bus riders, but also the metro system overall, because we know that many of the bus stops are actually vetoes to the metro system itself, Metro Rail. And I also wanted to commend you all for the diverse group of stakeholders and the constituencies that you were able to do the outreach to, both on constituency and income levels. And I'm hoping that as we develop out the action plan and really put that into implementation, that we'll continue to think about the diversity of our region and also an inclusive growth strategy that really incorporates the role of all of those who rely on Metro from an income and also a constituency baseline to be able to ensure that it is the number one mobility choice for the region, that people will be able to also see, as we've seen the increase on the rail side, that we'll see the increase on the bus side and being able to address the last mile challenge. And that both the staff and also the regional team will continue to really think about how we ensure that this supports our greater climate actions and many of our priorities, and just ensuring that this is the number one region for really seeing bus growth increase in terms of ridership. So thank you for all the work that you all have been able to do today.
Thank you. Before we move on to a vote, I did want to take advantage of your expertise and ask you a question. Because there was a story in the LA Times earlier this week on what LA Metro is going through, where they similarly, actually worse than us, have experienced a decline in ridership of about 25% on the bus in the last 10 years. And the story today, early this week, was a plan that LA Metro is putting forward to turn around their bus system, and the elements of that plan and 30,000 foot level, maybe this is a 40,000 foot level, include, a promise that buses will appear on routes every 10 minutes at the most, and 5 minutes better, to increase bus travel time. Another part of the plan is that there would be some lessening of the number of bus stops, so that there would be a bus stop only every quarter mile, so people would, as opposed to what the current closer every block would be, or every two blocks in the case of Washington. And a third part of that plan was to devote $750 million over the next few years to bus-only lanes and traffic light synchronization. And I guess my question to you, is that the kind of vision you see WMATA and the jurisdictions having to undertake to make a turnaround of Metro Bus a success in our region?
I think it's those kinds of things. Chairman, each region is different. As we've seen, some of the work that I do is national. I think that Phil Washington, who runs LA Metro, is one of the best in the country, and whatever he says, I think, is probably in the right direction. But each place is different. And I think what we tried to do with this report was not to just jump into operational improvements and those kinds of changes, but to take a step back in this case and think, what do we want the role of the bus to be in the future? Transportation is going through a dynamic and changing time right now, right? There's lots of different providers, and there's probably no more complex governance structure anywhere in the country than here in the D.C. region. So what is applicable in L.A. may inform what we do here in Washington, but I think it's going to have a different flavor. But that said, I think some of those things that you've outlined are in the right ballpark.
Specifically, what I was really trying to ask you is whether you thought that kind of capital cost of $750 million for bus-only lanes and traffic light synchronization is sort of in the ballpark. Obviously, that's not something that will be in the Metro budget. That would be mostly an expense that would be done by the jurisdictions, both the local jurisdictions and the state. But I'm really trying to get a sense of whether that's the kind of commitment financially that it's going to take to make this successful and turn around Metro Bus in this region.
I'm not sure about the financial commitment, but because of the reasons you mentioned, there's different jurisdictions here, different governance, but those ideas are important, for sure.
Thank you. Mr. Bolger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rob, good seeing you. Stuart, you said you didn't want a report that would just hold a door open. So here's the question I have. How are we going to test whether we're making progress. What kind of metrics did you guys think about? You know, was it, you know, 100 miles of busway, lanes, synchronous, you know, whatever. Well, how are you going to get back to us about how the jurisdictions, because we don't run the road. We run on the roads, or the arterials. What is the metric that we're going to be looking at a year from now, 2 years from now?
These are what we want the jurisdictional staff to help develop, because we do need to measure progress in order to figure out if we actually are making, because the recommendations in here are bold, and the things that we're calling for are pretty bold, and we need to figure out if we're actually having some progress. So we definitely need to develop those metrics, and we need to hold the region accountable for meeting the goals that are laid out. So I think all that still needs to be developed. That's really kind of the role of the jurisdictions, to figure out what we want the bus service to look like, but that accountability, metrics, and measuring progress has to be a part of this effort.
Well, who's going to do that, Rob? Who would do that? Who would be responsible for that kind of measurement?
That's a good question.
Stuart?
Well, I know it's sensitive, and we haven't reached consensus here, obviously, on the task force, but that was one of the reasons why we wanted to have a set of regional champions whose prime focus was the bus and tracking this sort of progress. In the absence of that, certainly we can create, there are metrics suggested in the report, and, you know, from a staff perspective, they can report to you and the jurisdictions on how we're doing in various metrics. They can negotiate with NVTC on what those metrics might be in Virginia and with their counterparts in Maryland. At the same time, rather than sit back, a number of our groups that sort of served on this committee were already working together under the Metro Now Coalition that won the first ever dedicated, helped you all win the first ever dedicated funding for Metro. And that's the Board of Trade, the Greater Washington Partnership, the 2030 Group, the Coalition for Smarter Growth, Federal City Council, and the Northern Virginia Chamber of Commerce. And rather than sit back, we're going to do our own report cards, and we'll be tracking the metrics. And we've set some goals in our analysis for some of the priority policies like dedicated bus lanes, route network redesign, fares, and other things that we see as priorities. So we're not going to let this drop. And I want to commend the business community. I don't know of any other region in the country where major regional business umbrella organizations like this have made the bus their top priority. Not some sexy light rail project, but the bus, and the bus for everyone that everyone needs to use here in this region.
Thank you. For purposes of the record, that was Stuart Schwartz, for posterity's sake. All right, so just to sum up procedurally, we're now going to vote on this as the Safety and Operations Committee, and then the Safety and Operations Committee will move it forward, assuming it's approved, to the full board at today's 1 p.m. board meeting, when all board members will have an opportunity to vote on it. So having said that, and since we've had a motion and second, call the question. All in favor of the draft resolution on the bus transformation project, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. Any opposed? Hearing none. Any abstentions? Seeing and hearing none. The bus transformation resolution of this board is approved and will be moved for action by the full board this afternoon. Thank you very much for everything. Thank you. That completes the Safety and Operations Committee meeting for today. Mr. Chairman, am I supposed to give the floor over to you? Okay.